Craig Berg is next. Welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Early on in the COVID-19 pandemic, information was released that indicated that singing was one of the riskiest behaviors when it came to the spread of COVID-19. What would this mean for choral music and for choir directors? On today's program, we're going to be hearing from two local collegiate choral directors about how they have tried to lead their choral programs safely through COVID-19. We begin with Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Later in the hour, we'll hear from his counterpart at Carthage College, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli. I began with Dr. Kinchin by asking him to remember what happened back in the spring when, in effect, everything came screeching to a halt as COVID-19 descended on this part of the world.
Well, of course, everybody knew about this virus, and of course, it was tenacious, and it was strange, and it was just very contagious, and it was having dire consequences for a lot of people who were contracting it, and so we made the decision that we had to stop doing our physical activities on campus. The timing of that was fortuitous in that it was right around spring break, as it was for many campuses. So that gave us a little bit of flexibility to kind of see what was going to happen. And of course, what happened for us was the decision, absolutely correct decision, to just stop everything face-to-face. And that included what we were doing with choral activities. We were at that point planning to do a semester, no big work for the choirs in the spring semester, but just planning to do what we normally do, and that is to experience choral music, to learn in the choral experience, to prepare for performances. All of that came to a screeching halt.
So did you end up doing much of anything in terms of those last few weeks of the semester, or was it essentially a suspension of everything choral music-wise, and what did that feel like?
Well, we actually did do something, and what we did, I think, under the circumstances, given especially given the suddenness with which these circumstances were thrust on us, I think was a good thing. We all connected virtually. We took from our folders of pieces that were under preparation a selection of the week, and that selection was posted. The links to the parts and the links to the full piece, either all of the parts together, as would be the case with the with an unaccompanied piece or accompaniment, and every student was given some guidelines for going online and connecting with their part and connecting with the piece, and they were put in the position, which I think was probably both daunting and empowering, of assessing their own efforts, talking about what they were doing in terms of the purely musical aspects, rhythms and pitches and texts and all of those things. but also talking about the emotional aspect engendered by the music itself and engendered by their having to now do this music in the isolation of their own private spaces without suddenly without the glorious company of all of the people who normally gather at the choir rehearsal to sing with them. And it was very revealing, and I maintained some dialogue with people as we went through that exercise. And so I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. As best we could, we still managed to effect some kind of community. As best we could, we still managed to make some music.
Hmm. So I suspect that you, during the summer, were busy, as a whole lot of your counterparts were, all across the country, and maybe around the world for that matter, in terms of trying to sort out the ways in which perhaps actual choral singing might be possible in the fall semester. Just tell us about some of the exploration that you did and some of the very careful consideration you made of such possibilities.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. I take my hat off to the wonderful colleagues here in the state who led by WCDA, Wisconsin Choral Directors Association President Zach Durlam, began having conversations about what we might do and trying to also wrap our minds around the science and to kind of have a space, a collegial space, if you would, in which we could put out there, this is what I think I want to do, and not necessarily be committed to doing that, but put it there so that there was some measure of critique and we could continue to understand the science better and figure out, this would probably work. Nah, this would not work. What was particularly helpful for us in the summer was the preliminary findings to a study that, by the way, is still ongoing, that came out. And we kind of referred to it colloquially as the Colorado study. But it was led by colleagues, one of our excellent national high school leaders, and colleagues from places as varied as Colorado, which is how it got its name, Clemson, and the University of Maryland. And the whole point of that was to try to be as abreast as possible of the science, understand the science, and see if we could, in a systematic, scientific way, figure out how the science would affect those of us who made music. When the first reports came out, what was particularly eye-opening, and I take you back, all of us back, to the time when this virus first appeared here in the U.S. And by the way, just an aside, a totally ironic note, it originated in Wuhan, China. I was in Wuhan, China in the summer of 2019, engaged in a choral exchange with some of my students. It's a wonderful experience, and how ironic that the virus that would eventually change our lives would have that as its point of origin, as far as we know.
Wow.
But anyway, as you recall, at the beginning of things, it was assumed that a lot of spread happened through the droplets that we emitted when we coughed, when we sneezed, when we talked loudly, and that sort of thing, and how, you know, we put our hands to our faces and they would become contaminated, and how these droplets with the virus in them would end up on surfaces. And so initially that was a big emphasis on, and all of these things are still germane, but a big emphasis on washing hands, a big emphasis on sanitizing surfaces. We began wearing masks, and I'm so glad that we started that, not fully understanding how efficacious that would be. In fact, some of the early science said, well, the mask doesn't give you much protection, but it protects others. We found out since that the mask affords protection for the wearer as well. So when the study came out, to get back to the study, it began to focus our attention on something that many of us did not fully understand in the early stages of the virus. And that was the gaseous emissions that we made that sort of went up and away coin the lyrics of the old song that nobody could see, okay, what became commonly called the aerosols. And this study began to focus on the aerosols to understand what emissions are produced when you play various wind instruments, for example. What emissions tend to be produced when you sing? Are there differences depending on voice parts? Are there differences depending on the style of singing that you do? Are there even differences that might relate to what vowel you're singing or what consonant you're singing? And this was extremely helpful at that point, because then we understood that unlike the common cold, unlike a lot of the variants of flu that we encounter from season to season, that a lot of the transmission happens in the air. That then explains why these wonderful choral singers in Oregon who had no idea about aerosols, so many of them got infected and some of them died in the process of having a choir rehearsal. So then, we began to understand what mitigants we might employ that might diminish the risk to the point that it was reasonable for us perhaps to do in-person singing. I often quote somebody, and I introduce them as one of our present-day philosophers, and people, of course, they kind of perk up because they want to know, who that might be. He's National Basketball Association Commissioner Adam Silver. And it was a quote that he generated at the time when NBA was trying to figure out what it was going to do. It ended up creating the bubble, which most of us know about. But his succinct summation absolutely continues to be relevant to what we do regarding COVID. He said, no option is risk-free. We go to the store, there's a risk. We've got to go and pick up a prescription from the drugstore. There's a risk involved. So the question is to balance risk and reward to the point that we are not so much hung up on we're going to sing, do or die, that we put people at risk beyond what is reasonably controllable. So what emerged from the study, and by the way, the more updated version of the study came out a few weeks ago, and it confirmed all of these earlier findings, that we have to maintain distance. That's totally valid, okay? It's true for people, who are going into the grocery store. It certainly is true for people who are making music together in the same space. We have to wear masks, okay? Because, and this was telling for me when I saw it. It was like, wow. They had some video footage of singers emitting. Now, these singers didn't have COVID as far as we know, but they were just showing that when a person emits, here's what happens. The singer emitting without the mask, there was this torrent, a torrent of gases, which was visible with the enhanced photography that you and I could not see with naked eye, that just kind of tumbled out and just kept going. You thought, oh my gosh, that's awful. Then the same singer doing the same singing with the mask on there were small emissions that were possible. We'll kiss a mask, obviously, at some level is porous, right? And but there was also this diversion, if you will, of emissions, deflection of emissions, so that sort of what did come out, most of what came out, went up, okay? And that was visibly less. And of course, they measured these things in scientific terms, and they confirmed that that the masks really helped. There was also this thing of how long can we sing in a room before the emissions, even controlled by the masks and so forth, become so overwhelming, they accumulate, and then they begin to just sort of fill up the air in the room. And so that was determined scientifically. And so we began to come up with this idea of what was reasonably safe in terms of singing in a space. We had to be distanced, we had to be masked. It was hugely important to have a space where there was a high ceiling. The exchange of air in the room had to be sufficient. So we started bothering our facilities people to find out what the turnover of air was in various spaces. But that had to be sufficient so that air was moving, the old air was moving out and fresh air was moving in. And so all of those things together sort of pointed to a practice that, given the fact that no options are risk-free, might allow us to sing physically in the same space with the smallest amount of risk possible.
I'm guessing that a real blessing for you and your colleagues at Parkside is the fact that so much of what you do is within the four walls of the beautiful Rita, that still relatively new addition to the Parkside campus, where so much of the theater and music department activities are housed. And I'm guessing that in at least most of the major spaces that you utilize, we're probably talking about a very good air exchange rate. And so you probably had a lot of viable options in terms of spaces where your choirs could safely rehearse. Am I right about that?
Yes. I have to confess this to you, that it was completed in 20 and opened in 2011, but it will always be new and will always be wonderful in terms of everything that it's afforded us, that reader space. And that mattered a great deal for us. I should also, though, tell you that earlier in the semester, this fall semester, we intentionally planned to have some rehearsals out of doors. And we did that several times. What that did is it allowed us to be in the safest space. The research shows that the very safest space is out of doors. And of course, distanced, okay, still, not out of doors, clumped together into big groups around, around tables or whatever, but distance. And so we did do some rehearsing out of doors. That also gave us the benefit of having everybody together. When we were indoors, distanced properly, we could not have the whole choir in the room at the same time. Okay. Even with the wonderful spaces of that Thetford Hall and the other reader rooms afford us. But that facility was for us a godsend. I don't know how we would have done any of what we did without having had that facility at our disposal. We were so fortunate.
What kind of challenge has it been in terms of having to share when they're even in a facility as beautiful as the Rita, there's a finite number of sizable spaces where a decent-sized group can really make music together? Or has there been sufficient space that there has been plenty of access for every major ensemble that would need and want such spaces for rehearsal?
I think there has been reasonable access simply because even under ideal circumstances, even under the normal situation, in the normal situation, we don't all do that at the same time. So because we have a schedule that has us doing some rotation, that helped a great deal. And also remember that there is no more 50, what is it on that campus, 53 minute rehearsal, okay? All that's been shrunk now to 30 minutes from the time my folks start singing, for example, until the time that we end the rehearsal, sometimes abruptly, is 30 minutes because the science supports that. And after you've been emitting in a space for over 30 minutes, then you have this inevitable buildup of aerosols. So the fact that not only do you have staggered scheduling, but you also have shortened periods of time that you're in there, and there is some time then in the space for the space to, and I put this in air quotes, recover. You know, in other words, you've had sufficient air exchange. So that's not so, you know, so huge a problem. Yeah?
Tell us what it was like for your students to be singing under such dramatically different circumstances, or by and large, do you think it felt for them like business as usual to a remarkable extent? I mean, how different did this feel for your students to be singing together this fall?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I think it's sort of, you know, you hate to trot Dickens out all the time, you know, the best of times, the worst of times. I think looking at it from the deficit perspective, it took quite a bit of singing for people to get used to the masks. Now, we ordered for them this mask called the singer's mask, which is a really well-constructed mask that performs the functions of a mask in the pandemic, but it does so while allowing some space in front, inside the mask, in front of the mouth and nose to make singing an easier thing than it would otherwise be. It's no safer than any other mask, okay? But it simply is more singer friendly. But they still had to get used to doing that. I had to get used to hearing them sing through the mask, okay? Hmm. A good deal of what we do as choral directors, as choral artists and educators, is we analyze and we react to what we hear, okay? And so that was greatly altered as people sang. Students had to come into the room under normal circumstances. You could come in clumps and who would care? You know, we're all buds together. But there had to be distancing there. There were spots assigned to people inside the space, sort of stand on the X kind of thing. And people had to be very disciplined in that way. We were further affected by the fact that you didn't, except for outdoors, you know, you never had everybody there. So there always was the critical mass that you weren't quite able to sort of muster in the indoor setting. And even splitting people up into who will be in the space today, who will be in bed for today, or who will be in the choir room today. You know, even that could not be done in a totally balanced way because the sections to start out with were imbalanced. And then there were students who were there in the spring who were some of the stronger vocalists who for one reason or another were not there in the fall. So that created sort of a vacuum. And then, of course, you had the inevitable movement of students out and back in, depending on whether they had been close contacts with somebody who had been diagnosed or tested positive, whether they shared a living space with somebody who had. I had more than a couple of students to say to me via email, my mom got tested and she was positive, or my brother or whatever. So you have all of those kinds of things so that at any given moment, a section may be reasonably strong or it may be decimated by people who are there. So the students had to deal, you know, with all of those variables. And if I thought about it more, I could probably mention more on the negative side. But on the positive side, they got to sing together. And it convinced me, not that I needed to be convinced after all these years as a choral artist and choral educator, but it convinced me of the validity of this thing that we do call choral music, that it is special in ways that we often don't even understand, even as we are sort of moving deliberately, but with reasonable pace toward the finished product and all of those things, that it has meaning for people sometimes outside of rhythms and pitches and texts and chords and all of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And the students, I'm thoroughly convinced, in spite of all of those obstacles, all of those inconveniences, the students thoroughly enjoyed and appreciated and benefited from the opportunity to be in the same space and to make music together.
Dr. James Kinchin is Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
And now we turn to Dr. Kinchin's counterpart over at Carthage College, namely Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who is the Director of Choral Activities at Carthage College, where I teach. And among other duties and responsibilities, Dr. Garcia Novelli is conductor of the Carthage Choir. And so he has been dealing with all of the same restrictions and complications Dr. Kinchin has been dealing with at Parkside, and for that matter, colleges and universities and schools of all levels all across the country and around the world. How do we sing safely together in this time of the COVID-19 pandemic? So we'll revisit a few of the same questions and see how they've been handled at Carthage. Dr. Garcia Novelli, it's good to see you and good to have you on the morning show.
Great to be here, Greg. Thank you.
Take us back to the spring when COVID-19 first kind of descended. I remember, in a sense, experiencing it with you because you and I were both with the Carthage Choir on a short tour. And my recollection is, as we're kind of on our way back to Carthage, that's when you were starting to receive some of the first reports about COVID-19 and just how serious this was looking to be.
That's exactly right. It was the weekend of March 8, 9, 10, whatever it was. And we went to Milwaukee and then to Madison. Coming back from Madison, it was on Tuesday the 10th that we were starting to hear some of those reports on the possibility of this happening. And of course, at that time, you know, it all seemed to be something unthinkable, right? That we would close even for a day or two or a week or whatever. But it came to be.
I honestly don't remember what the Carthage Choir did for the remainder of that spring semester when we were entirely virtual. I mean, nobody on campus teaching in person at all. Did the Carthage Choir do much for the remainder of the semester? And if so, what did they do?
Not much. Let's remember that at the beginning, the closure was supposed to be for 3 weeks, right, until Easter time, I think, or Easter Sunday. And then we were supposed to come back. Of course, everybody knows that we didn't. And so it was for the entirety of the semester. So at the beginning, we had the plan. And the plan A, I guess, was to prepare coming back after Easter. And so then when it didn't happen, we didn't have much of a choice. So we actually met on Zoom gatherings once a week or sometimes a few more times than that, but it was mostly once a week in which we just shared material, listened to music, looked at music that we were going to do the following year, or listened to recordings of the choir when we were on tour in Europe the years before, things like that. But not really rehearsing, because you know that you cannot rehearse via Zoom because of issues of latency. So,
right, that things aren't in sync time-wise, and so
exactly.
Yeah, it's really impossible over Zoom to even singing Happy Birthday together.
That's right.
A big mess, let alone anything more complicated. So I'm anxious to hear your perspective on what I asked Dr. Kinchin about the summer in anticipation of the fall, which the plan was going to be kind of a mix of virtual, starting virtual, but then resuming in-person education and presumably in-person choral education. And so what kinds of things were you thinking about and weighing during the summer in anticipation of the fall semester in terms of how to do this well and safely?
Well, it was a big thing about walking into the unknown, right? Is when you are exposed to something completely new and you have to learn a new way of doing things. And number one, if you can at all do them at all. So it was a lot about collecting information. I know that you and your audience have heard about the Colorado study and things like that. That was probably the defining moment and the defining information about what to do and how to proceed. It was important for us to rely on the information provided by some folks on campus, the maintenance office, and those people that were producing studies about each one of the rooms at Carthage, in each one of the buildings, with information about air exchange. That was vital, right? To know, I guess, if I can translate this in plain language, how many times per minute the air in a room gets exchanged, right? And in essence, cleaned up because of the UV technology and the HIPAA filters and all that kind of thing. So I think that was a defining moment, the two of them, the Colorado study and the information from school, in order to be able to operate health in a healthy way, right? And then, of course, we had to proceed about the definition of what it means to sing, of course, with masks all the time and with distancing. So what does it mean and how we can operate in that context? So you, of course, being a professor at Carthage, you know exactly the choir room at Carthage, how big it is and how many people it holds. And we quickly realized that, for instance, for any of the choral activities at Carthage, the choir room was not going to be usable anymore.
It's too small.
Right. At least for the regular size ensembles, for the, you know, large ensembles. And so that turned to be inoperable for the entire semester, actually. So we had to look for places on campus that would allow for that to happen. And we spent time, we went to several places on campus, studied all possible options, marked the floors with, you know, green dots, you know, self-adhesive green dots for people to be safely distanced. And we had, as a result of that, we discovered different places on campus that we never thought of being places possible for us to use as rehearsal venues. And I think that we were successful in accommodating that.
One thing that apparently was paramount importance in the Colorado study is the matter of duration, and the fact that when you had these terrible and tragic stories of, I think in many cases it was community choruses here or there that would have these long rehearsals, and then dozens and dozens of choir members will have ended up catching the virus, in many cases many people getting very sick, even dying, that a big part of why those terrible outbreaks occurred within these choral groups was the matter of duration, how long they were singing together. And that if you sang together too long, particularly without sufficient distancing, you're just escalating the amount of exposure or potential exposure. So what kind of limitations were you operating within in terms of length of time that it would be safe for the choir to sing together in a given space.
Yes, true. The limit for the study is 30 minutes, right? And that means that you can be rehearsing in a given location for 30 minutes, and you have to effectively exit the place, leave the place, and let the place breathe, so to speak, right, for at least 15 minutes in order to come back to the same location. So at the beginning, actually, we used that strategy. So reducing the rehearsal time to two blocks of 25 minutes, so 25 minutes, 15 minutes going out, and 25 minutes coming back. But then as the semester progressed and we learned about other locations on campus in which we could work, so we started using two blocks of 30 minutes. So 30 minutes in one location, and then actually walking out of the building and walking about, I don't know, two or three blocks to another building and using this other location. And that actually was very effective because it saved time or added time to rehearsal that was always very valuable. Any ensemble values rehearsal time because that's the only time that you're together is that, you know, the time that you are learning, practicing, and studying together. So that was very beneficial.
What kind of musical and artistic difference do you think it made in terms of working with the choir, in terms of what their experience was, for them to be singing in rehearsal in this kind of strange formation? I mean, unlike what they are accustomed to, where they're seated in the choir room, sitting right next to each other, to be at a distance from one another, and in a room not designed for choral rehearsal. Did you feel like that made much of a difference or not much difference at all? Did the ultimate sort of central experience remain pretty much the same as it would have otherwise have been?
It was different. It was very different. Perhaps from outside, the result is more or less the same. More or less, I say, because of course it's not the same to sing with the mask than without. Just the sound, the sheer sound gets a little dampened, if that is a term, a little bit, or it changes the quality of the sound, right? So there is a little bit of change there, but it's not, I would say, the biggest from the point of view of the singer and or director. I think the biggest challenge is the distance and being able, everybody in the choir and the conductor, to listen to each other. If you are far away from each person producing sound, so then it is more difficult to hear that person that's far away. And somebody who is 6 feet apart, that's not so much of a problem. But somebody that is 20 feet away or 30 feet away from you, and it happens. So that is difficult. When you perform in any type of ensemble, particularly in a choir, where your intonation depends on what the other people are doing, then that becomes critical, right? And if the acoustics of the place is relatively dry, defining dry as a place where the sound one produces sort of evaporates quickly and doesn't sort of resonate and stay in the air for a little longer, or doesn't come back to you, like as if were a refraction or reflection, I guess, from the walls or from the ceiling or whatever. So then becomes a little trickier or even more difficult to listen to each other and to be together. And that's the second part, not only the intonation, but also the rhythmical aspect for the group to be, just basically be together, rhythmically together, right? Having also the conductor far away makes it complicated, right? You need to basically trust in what you see all the time and not so much in what you hear in terms of being together. And on the other side, I would say that the challenge for me as conductor, for years I have taught of the importance of your face as a conductor, right? And your expression and your communication with your eyes and with your mouth and especially with your breath. When where looking relaxed and open to your singers so they can see there's at the moment of the initiation of the phrase of the breath for the singer. It's so important for them, in my idea, for them to see that I am breathing with them, that I am with them. Well, now with a mask, all of a sudden they can't see it. I can't show it. I can't use that conducting resource to communicate. So it has to be down to just hand moving, which makes it much more difficult and much more cold of sorts, because you just simply moving hands. And that's probably, for me, from the conducting point of view, probably that was the biggest challenge of all.
Also the challenge of having students that had to be gone, going into self-quarantine because of COVID, I know is a big challenge. As far as I'm aware, in the Carthage Choir, which is just under 50 members, there was only one student who was ever diagnosed positively as with COVID-19. But there was a, I mean, I could be wrong about that, but that, I only know of one. But you had all these other students who were potentially exposed and had to go into quarantine or self-isolation. Just tell us the dimensions of that problem and how significant it was.
Well, number one, and this lovely, young, fantastic singer was diagnosed, yes, correct. But it's important to notice that even though this person doesn't know exactly where he got it from at this point, there's no information. Chances are it was not within the choir, but because nobody else apparently, or not apparently, when nobody else was officially diagnosed. So that's one important one thing. It's interesting to notice this, that this person came to a rehearsal, to the rehearsal on a given Monday, I think it was, and also surely the Friday before. And the person was diagnosed on Tuesday. So that means that person was with us rehearsing with a mask always and distancing. And there was no official other cases. So nobody else contracted the disease, the virus, because of this person. So that means that evidently, at least as the little science that we can attest to with our study case, masks and distancing really works, because that is a clear example of what happened. You're right, and a number of other students had to be quarantined when they were exposed to other students or on campus or whatever. So that was a challenge, I must say. On a regular rehearsal, it's normal to have somebody missing for different reasons, because they're ill or they have a family emergency or whatever the situation is. And I always have like an unwritten rule that, you know, something like having 5% of a choir missing is normal, is within normalcy, and a rehearsal can go well, no problem. So in a 45-member choir, having 2 or 3 people missing is normal, and under just the choir can function normally without a problem. Well, we had many days, you may remember, Greg, that we had, I don't know, like 3 weeks or something like that, in which, or more, in which we had days of 10, 11, or 12 members missing. So we're talking about 20%, 25% of the choir missing. And that is a huge challenge, especially when you deal with repertoire that has a lot of divisi, right, that you divide in multiple parts per voice part. So that makes it even much more demanding.
Right, so it's not just you have a bunch of tenors missing, but when you have 4 of your 5 first tenors missing.
Right,
and
exactly.
Their own part, yeah, it's incredible. That brings to mind the fact that one of the decisions you made, I think it was a decision, maybe it wasn't a conscious decision, but what ended up happening is you chose plenty of music that was extremely difficult. I mean, of comparable difficulty to any sort of normal year with the Carthage Choir. In other words, you opted not to choose music that would have been simpler to learn. I'm curious, now that you have survived the semester, you and the students, does any part of you regret that? Or do you feel like that ultimately was for the best, that you proceeded with a very exacting, demanding kind of repertoire that pushed everybody to their limits?
Looking back, I think that, or better say, going to the fast forward to the end, I'm happy that we did. And I don't think that it was the wrong thing to do. But looking back during the semester when we were in the middle of working on this and having people absent and things like that, in the middle of that, I thought, oh boy, that was not clever for me to not only include repertoire with a lot of difficulty, but also, if you remember, Greg, well, because you play for the choir, only one of those pieces was with piano, right? So obviously, when in a choir, you have repertoire with a fixed intonation, right, like the piano is, the piano is providing a source of information in terms of pitch, right? Also rhythm, but basically pitch. So then part of the work, so to speak, is done, or it is very helpful in at least the learning period and the moment where you come to perform it. When you do repertoire that is entirely a cappella, then the singers do not have anything to grab from. They have to grab from their ears, their in internal audiation, and also from the sound that other fellow singers produce. So that's the only thing they can rely on. So that, by definition, singing a cappella is more difficult and it takes more time, right, by definition. And if you apply to that levels of difficulty that are very high, and you apply to that also singing another language, luckily it was only like Latin, that is not so foreign to choral singers. But still, right, even if it is in English, it adds a high level of difficulty. If I would go back to the beginning and knowing that we were going to have, you know, people absent, so I probably would have either included more repertoire with accompaniment and or perhaps not as difficult. But there was a reason for us to include repertoire of high level and high difficulty. There is a possibility, if everything goes okay and we are allowed to travel, for the choir to go to Europe again next June.
Well, we all are anxious for the day when all of this can feel a little more normal than it does right now. But in the meantime, I know that you feel really good about what this experience has been. And in particular, I've heard you tell the students about how valuable it is to have to overcome difficulty and adversity. That's certainly been served up in a great amount here.
I'm glad you bring it back, bring that up, Greg, because I think it's the biggest thing. I mean, if I have to sum it up to one thing, I don't care about, you know, how beautiful or how effective we had a semester or the music we did or whatever. I think the lesson that we all learned is that we were able to do it. And the expression I think I used in the last day of classes was conquering adversity, right? Going through something that was hard. I'm not talking about the music, but rather the situation itself. And the situation is not the best. You know that there is adversity ahead of you and in front of you. You're living in adversity, and you go through it, and you conquer it, and you make it happen anyway, no matter what. The funny thing, funny is not the right term, but the thing is that life is that, is like, going through life means that you go from one small adversity to another, perhaps from a very little one to a medium-sized one to a large one, right? And being exposed to something like this, I'm going to make an analogy with the vaccine, is like, it's giving us antibodies, right, to be prepared and to react to other adversities in life. And I think that as a learning experience, we all together, all the singers and ourselves as directors and pianists and whatever, and as a school, we really have succeeded in this task, right? In conquering adversity.
Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, the Director of Choral Activities at Carthage and Chair of the Music Department during these challenging days, I appreciate you being part of the morning show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me again.
Thank you.
Monday on the morning show, I'm very, very excited to share with you an interview which I recorded with Lucinda Robb, who is the granddaughter of Lady Bird and Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Rebecca Boggs Roberts, daughter of Cokie Roberts, lifelong friends, and the author of an absolutely fascinating and inspiring book called The Suffragist Playbook, Your Guide to Changing the World, a look back at the extraordinary women who were part of the suffrage movement and what they can teach us about